Chapter 4. Great Balls of Fur. It takes every ounce of your strength not to become what they make of you. Your spirit could implode under the pressure, the way that mine did that day with Brett. But in a new way that opened my eyes, letting me see the trouble brewing around me, trouble that everyone else was blind to. The winter carnival was a tradition in our town, started by a mayor too cheap to pay for a summer carnival. Since no one else wanted to throw a carnival in the dead of winter, we ended up with twice the rides at half the price for 2 whole weeks instead of just one. This year, I got a weekend job at one of the carnival ticket booths to take my mind off things. You learn a lot working at a ticket booth. The conversations of people in line make you a local expert, because the ticket booth is a crossroads for all the gossip in our town. Who was getting married and who was likely to get divorced, who was cheating on his or her spouse, and who was cheating the government. I learned so much about Alex Smarts that I could have written his biography. There were kids who were impressed by him, younger kids mostly. 7th and 8th graders idolized him. There were girls who vied for his attention and were endlessly irritated by the fact that Cheryl got most of it. And then there were others. The ones who neither worshipped nor fawned. The ones who were not amused. The way he plays that saxophone, you'd think he was born with it growing from his mouth, they would say, or... what does he have, a homing beacon in his baseball mitt? It wasn't so much their words, but the way that they said them, oozing with hatred. A girl whose name I didn't know talked to me as I sold her tickets, telling me how Alec became the overnight star of the chess team. "He keeps stomping on you until you stop moving," she said. "He doesn't just beat you, he squashes you." And she was right. It was like anyone with any talent was a cockroach he had to crush. Someone ought to do something about him, she said. Someone ought to put him in his place. Then she winked at me. Of course, it would take more than one person to do it right, suggested the chess girl. Make it so it would stick. It would take kids with experience in that sort of thing. Now I realize why so many of the conversations about Alec were loudly spoken in my direction. Someone ought to put him in his place. More than one person had suggested that to me. And with it came that unspoken threat. If you don't, Jared, then we will. Here are your tickets, I told her. If you want more, go to the other booth across the park. Don't come back to me. I saw Alec and Cheryl at the carnival that Sunday, before my shift ended. They had already been to the Midway, because Alec was carrying around this huge blue giraffe that he had won at one of the games. Although he could have left it somewhere, he made a point of lugging it around as he zigzagged through the carnival, in case there was anyone left who hadn't seen that he won it. I imagined him sitting in his garage for weeks on end, hurling footballs at tires or tossing coins at little glass plates, so when it finally came time for the real event, he would do it in just one shot, making it look like anyone should have been able to do it. I was the one who noticed all the looks he got, the wide-eyed looks from those in his fan club, and the narrow-eyed glares from those who resented him. When my shift was over, I wandered through the fair, trying to convince myself that I wasn't really looking for Alec and Cheryl. His big stuffed giraffe was sitting propped up against the rail of the bumper boats. The line had already emptied out onto the semicircular dock of the bumper boat pool. I hopped the rail and handed a few ride tickets to the attendant. He pointed me to one of the last available boats that actually worked. Then started my engine with a pull cord, like a lawnmower. Bumper boat racing is more or less an individual sport. One person per boat, and everybody out for themselves. Even when you try to do it in teams, it's never long before your own teammates turn on you without warning. The little inner tube boats began to bounce around like angry atoms in a mad scientist's brew, with everyone trying to keep away from the ice water fountain in the center of the tank. You'd think somebody would realize that getting drenched in the middle of winter wasn't anyone's idea of a good time. Alec and Cheryl were in different boats, spinning circles and careening into everyone around them. They hadn't seen me yet. I worked my way towards them, giving a full throttle to the gutless boat engine. By the time I reached the far side of the pool, Cheryl had been carried off in a current of boats. I floored my accelerator and hit Alec from behind, sending him spinning around and bouncing off the sidewall. It got his attention. "Jared," he said, calling out to me over the noise all around us. "I thought that they had you locked up in the ticket booth." I escaped. He bumped me, and before I knew it, we were moving in a circle around the outer edge of the pool, bumping into each other. "So how do you like our school?" I asked him. You came to the bumper boats to ask me about school, he said, sideswiping me. I came around, pinning him against the dock. I came to tell you you might be too busy to notice. I notice everything. He tried to squeeze his way past, but I just stayed in front of him, keeping him pushed up against the dock. You might not notice this. Come on, Jared, he said. I paid good money for the ride. Those were my last tickets. I'll give you new tickets, I said to him. Just listen. I leaned forward, getting as close to him as I could, and I said as quietly I could under the circumstances. You need to watch yourself, I told him, because there are some people who aren't too happy with your success. I just felt I should warn you. Then his face hardened as he looked at me. Are you threatening me? But before I could answer, I was hit so hard from behind that my boat spun circles, and my head was slow to catch up. It was Cheryl. You were a sitting duck, she said. It was my moral obligation to nail you. The ride attendant called the boats in, and the kids that resisted got pulled back to the dock with a long hook. Alec topped out of his boat, but my knobbly wees were stuck. He came up to me, leaned over me, and said, not too loud, but loud enough for Cheryl to hear, Don't think I don't know about you and those awful things you made Cheryl do in the Shadow Club. That's what this is all about? Asked Cheryl. But before I could explain myself, Alec put his arm around her and led her away. He's just a little jealous, that's all, he said. He'll get over it. I didn't even try to stammer out any further explanation, because I knew that no matter what I said or denied, I would look as guilty as a corporate executive in a news interview. So I just sat there with my legs uncomfortably wedged into a tiny boat until the carny came to shoo me out. It began less than half an hour later. There were several versions of the story, but when you put them all together, you come up with this. Alec and Cheryl were sitting in the heated dance canopy, eating hot dogs and listening to a bad country western band. There were other kids at the tables around them and a few people on the dance floor. Everyone was having a good old country time until Alec started taking a few sips from his Dr. Pepper. He complained that it tasted funny and very innocently took off the plastic lid to reveal that the Dr. Pepper shared the cup with a hairball the size of King Kong. In fact, if you believe the various accounts, the cup had more hair than soda. In a few seconds, Alec's face went through every shade of the visible spectrum before he leaped up, accidentally dumping the table and the hairy Dr. Pepper right into Cheryl's lap. Some say he puked right then and there, while others say he puked all over the dance floor. Still, others claim he puked all over the lead singer's shiny red boots, but wherever his cookies landed, the fact that he tossed them was not in dispute. The story spread so quickly that a sonic boom echoed through the phone lines, and by morning, the furry pepper incident, as it was now being called, was quickly becoming a town legend like the Shadow Club itself. And that had me more scared than I had been in months. I know what it's like to be trapped in a burning building, to have the smoke blind you and the air turn into a furnace as you struggle to open a door. Everything's so far out of control that you can't even control your own bladder. I also know power. I've watched my will run unchecked, wreaking havoc among friends and enemies alike. I know how good it feels to be in control, to feel that control reach beyond the limits of yourself until you feel larger than life. I know helplessness, and I know power. And if I had my way, I would never want to be in either one of those places again. Because while one might burn your body, the other one burns your soul. If anything good came from the Shadow Club's dark adventure, it was the knowledge that I was capable of incredible acts of bravery, as well as profound acts of malice. Knowing the bad stuff is there is a good thing, I think, because you can always see it coming. You can protect yourself. You can chase it away before it takes hold and does any damage. But you can't fight what you can't see. And far too many kids didn't see the furry pepper incident for what it really was. Who didn't know that even the Great Flood began with a single drop of rain? Did you do it? Cheryl accosted me in a dead-end hallway in the math department. We were both late for class, but then, what choice did we have? Neither of us were willing to talk about this during passing time, when ears with the sensitivity of Geiger counters were hyperextended to hear gossip. Do you think I did it? I asked. Are you going to play games with me? I shifted my heavy math book to my other hand. I suppose if I pleaded the fifth, you'd take my silence as guilt, wouldn't you? Why are you even asking if I've already been tried and convicted? Did you do it? She demanded again. I found myself getting more and more angry that she, of all people, thought I was still capable of that. "If I had a new girlfriend," I asked her, "would you put a clump of Bigfoot in her coke?" "No," she said, grimacing at the thought. "Of course not." "Then how could you think that I would?" She stood silently for a moment. I could see her shoulders relax. "So you're saying that you didn't do it?" I held out my book. "Do you want me to swear in my math book?" "No," she said. The second bell rang, announcing that we were officially late without an excuse. "Alex says you threatened him. I warned him that there were some kids who aren't too happy with him. He just assumed I meant me." "Are you jealous of him? Because he's going out with me?" I wish I could have flatly denied it. I mean, what kind of moron admits to his former girlfriend's face that he's jealous? I guess I was that moron. "Yeah," I told her. "Yeah, I am. A little. But that's not what this is all about." And then, to my amazement, she said something that no one has said to me for a long time. "I believe you." I should have shut my mouth then. Quit while I was ahead, but of course I didn't. "Actually, I kind of like Alec," I said. "I mean, he's an okay guy once you get past his perfection problem." She looked at me sideways, and that one look told me I was done for. "What do you mean by that?" "Well, just, that he's weird about being good at everything." "There's nothing wrong with aiming high. There's when you're hunting ducks with a bazooka." By now, I was so far into it that there was no sense pulling back. "I mean, overkill must be the guy's middle name. It's like he would die if somebody else got to be the center of attention." She crossed her arms in a prosecutor posture. "If he's so totally into himself," she said, far too calmly, "then why is he helping me run for class president?" I stumbled over my own thoughts for a moment, wondering when she decided to run and why I didn't know about it. There was a time when I would have been first to know. "That's great," I said. "I'm glad he'll be helping your campaign," and then I added, "Prove me wrong about him, and I'll eat my shoe." "You're on," she said, shaking my hand. "Only I get to pick which one. I want to make sure it's nice and grungy." She turned and strode off to class, but I couldn't let her go. Not yet, because there was something I had to tell her. Something I had been thinking about since the moment I heard about the hairball. "I've been thinking of reconvening the Shadow Club." My words stopped her dead in her tracks. But she didn't turn around. She just stood there for a few seconds, her back still turned. "I thought maybe we could all get together and stop things from happening to Alec," I told her. "You won't need to stop it, because nothing else will happen," she said, and continued on to class. The administrators of our school district haven't quite come to grips with the 21st century, or even the 20th for that matter. Our desks are the same shellacked, pen-carved relics that they used to be 50 years ago. There are still holes and inkwells in the corner. We're not required to wear uniforms, but every Friday we still have to dress up for assembly. We also have that rare animal called a junior high school, 7th, 8th, and 9th grades all together, leaving only 3 grades for our senior high school. If it were up to our district superintendent, I'm sure we would all be in a little red schoolhouses that dotted the coastline. I really didn't mind the junior high school thing. I mean, sure, I wanted to be in high school, but there was something to be said about never having a freshman year. Our town only has one junior high and one senior high, massive buildings across town from each other, built in the days when schools were giant institutions like prisons, which meant that few things would change when I made my move from the 9th to 10th grade, other than the length of my run every day. Same basic kids, same basic attitudes, and what you sowed in kindergarten, you were still reaping in 12th grade. Since the senior high only had one feeding school, it had been decided some years ago that during the winter lull, after Christmas vacation and before standardized tests, elections would be held for the next year's class president. Whoever won the honor in 9th grade would walk right into senior high, master of 10th grade. Nominations came during the next Friday's assembly. The assembly featured a former state representative who was so old we were afraid he would expire before his parking meter outside. Following him were our official presidential nominations. It was common knowledge by now that Cheryl planned to run. She had weathered the storm of the Shadow Club far better than I had. Rather than earning her the label of questionable kid, as it did for me, her involvement left an aura of awe around her. It was just the kind of quality that could get a person elected, and she knew it. Of course, you can't nominate yourself, and so when the call came for nominations, I quickly raised my hand to nominate her. Turns out I didn't need to. Alec held his hand high right next to her. He drew the principal's attention, as he always drew everyone's attention. He was called on first. "I nominate Cheryl Gannett," he said. "I second that," shouted somebody else. "I accept," said Cheryl, as if there would be any doubt. I observed as the nominations went around the auditorium. In all, there were about a dozen, but when push came to shove, few of them were second, and so those kids' names never made the list. In the end, it was Cheryl, Tommy Nichols, who was expected to be the school's valedictorian, and Katarina Mendelson, who had been trying to get elected since fourth grade. As the principal called for final nominations, one more hand went up. This hand belonged to Calvin Horner, a snively kid with a bit of a speech impediment, and teeth almost as yellow as his hair. I wondered what on earth would possess him to stand up and speak in front of a crowd, when it was always such a chore for him to answer a simple question in class. "I would like to nominate Alex Smarts for class president," Calvin said. There were more seconds than I could count, followed by a low afterburn of grumbles from those who were not pleased. I turned to see Alec shrug innocently at a gaping Cheryl as he said loudly, "I guess I accept." That's when I saw Calvin Horner give a little nod to Alec, making it very clear that this was not a spontaneous act. On Monday, I came to school with a shoebox under my arm and approached Cheryl at her locker. Holding it like a waiter with a tray, I pulled off the lid. "Canvas or leather?" I said. "Your choice." Instead, of course, were one of my dress shoes and a sneaker, so grungy it could be considered hazardous waste. Oh, shut up. I had to admit I felt bad for her, and guilty for having rubbed her nose in it. I shoved the shoebox under my arm. "Sorry," I said. "I'm sorry Alec wasn't really behind you. It would have been great if you could have worked together. Actually, things will still work out. Chances are that one of us will win and the other will take second place, which means we'll be each other's vice president." "I don't think so," I said. "Two possibilities, assuming Katarina or Tommy didn't pull out. Either A, he'll win and leave you his vice president. Or B, you'll win and he will melt like the Wicked Witch of the West." "Well, now you're just being nasty." "No, I'm serious. Alec is not a vice president kind of guy. He might say so now, but that's just because he doesn't believe it will ever happen." She slammed her locker, incredibly angry about how sure I was, and maybe a bit bothered by the knowledge that I was right. "That's your opinion," she said. "And if I didn't want your vote, I would tell you exactly where you could put that opinion." There was a commotion further down the hall. I didn't take much note of it until I both heard the name Alex Smarts mumbled more than once. We went over to find out what was going on. "Did you hear what happened to Alec?" said a kid who was anxious to tell anyone that would listen. "What?" asked Cheryl apprehensively. "He got skunked," the kid said. "Him and his whole family." Cheryl's first reaction was relief that it hadn't been anything really bad. But that relief was quickly overshadowed by suspicion. Wait a second. Skunks aren't out at this time of year. Maybe he went poking in a hole where it was hibernating or something, I suggested. "Nope," said the kid. "It happened in their van. They got in it this morning, the skunk popped out from under the seat, and the rest is history." Suddenly, I got that same sense of looming doom when I first heard about the hairball in his soda. Unless skunks had acquired the ability to teleport, it was clear that it had been intentionally slipped into the Smarts' family van. Alec didn't show up for school that day, but he was there the next day. Although he tried to act as if nothing was wrong, the burned rubbery smell of skunk surrounded him like killer BO, no matter how many demusking baths he took. And as for that minivan, it couldn't have been more totaled if it had fallen off a cliff. Although Alec didn't accuse me to my face, the accusation was there all the time. It was the way he looked at me, or refused to look at me. The second day after the skunking, he came up to me as we were leaving English class, one of the few classes we had together. He didn't just bump into me. He made a point of coming up to me, and although he hadn't said a word to me in 2 days, he looked at me, grinning in a way that I couldn't quite read, and said, "Nice shirt." I figured he was just trying to bother me, you know, the way you say, "Nice socks," to someone whose socks are perfectly fine, making him wonder for the rest of the day what the heck is wrong with his socks. I just stored it away in my brain. The weird thing Alex said wasn't the only thing bothering me. In fact, He didn't bother me as much as the looks I got from other kids, suspicious glances that were more obvious than ever before. As I pulled books from my locker the next day, someone behind me said, "Good one, Jared." I spun on my heel, but when I looked at the kids around me, I couldn't tell who it had been. It could have been any of them. All of them. A hallway full of faces convinced that the Shadow Club and I had been responsible for the skunk as well as the hairball. That afternoon, I slipped messages into 6 different lockers. Messages that called the Shadow Club back from the dead.